Good morning.
Good morning.
It's 10:50, so we'll get started, and there might be other people coming along. My name is Mike Wilker. I've met all of you. So you know that I'm the executive director of the Lutheran Volunteer Corps, that I'm a pastor, that I'm married to Judy, who's here, and we have two kids, that we live in Washington, D.C. And you all know, I think, a bit about Lutheran Volunteer Corps already, too. Like, some of you have been in LVC, like Ellen and Judy and me. So I'll kind of skip that part of the introduction and just lay out what I want to do is something that I think fairly simple, but what I've been trying to do this week is give people some frames or tools for how to enter in and live in the world. And today I'm going to talk about what I see as, and learn this from Larry Rasmussen, bye Bones, four streams within the Christian tradition that are flowing that may help us live more simply and sustainably. In the Lutheran Volunteer Corps, one of our values is to live simply and sustainably. And in our houses, this is oftentimes the area where we get the most self-righteous. Well, I'm going to do it this way, and I'm doing it this way, or you're not simple enough. And
it's like that 20 years ago, too.
Right. So, hi, welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Come on in. We're just getting started.
You have to wait.
Yes.
Get the last sticky bun, I bet.
Hey. You licking your finger on back there. Yeah, yeah.
So, I was just saying that I'm trying to give people some tools or frames in which to enter and engage the world. And in LVC, the Lutheran Volunteer Corps, one of our values is to live simply and sustainably. But around this, within households and within our community, we get a bit self-righteous. Like, well, I'm going to do it this way, and if you don't do it that way, then you're not as simple and sustainably and ecologically sound as I am. And I read an article by Larry Rasmussen once, and he's a Lutheran environmental theologian, a Bonhoeffer scholar as well. And he discerned these four streams within the Christian traditions. And when I started thinking about these four streams, I started to see them as, no wonder there's these different responses to living environmentally or sustainably in the world. It's because they're standing in a different stream. And all four streams may be places by which we make choices and decisions. But they'll be different. And I think that was helpful for me to see, okay, so someone's going to do this, and I'm not going to do that, because I'm going to make a different sustainable choice. And they're making a different sustainable choice than me. And if I can see the stream that they're living in, then I might be more gracious in my interaction with them. And also that the streams and seeing the streams might also help me make some decisions differently at different places in my life, different aspects. So what I'll do today with you all is I'm going to lay out these four streams and then give you some ways to think about them, and then just use coffee as an example of how you might make different choices depending on which stream you're standing in. And we can be very open and all, and see where it goes. So one thing about this is that these are categories, these streams really, typologies, and so Larry Rasmussen is distinguishing among these streams, where in reality they're flowing in and amongst one another oftentimes. So they might not be always separate in reality, but in order to tease them apart and see them and help make decisions based upon them, that's what we're doing here today. But as we get into our discussions and all, you'll see that, or even as I'm trying to write it up on the board, how they'll flow into one another at times. First I'll just put up all four of the streams. And so the first one,
It's willed to be closed.
Spear says we're not leaving. Who is thinking of leaving?
Yeah, I was just gonna say, aren't they left?
Stuck inside the whale.
Just here for 3 days?
Not bad company.
We'll miss the bus.
All right, so the four streams are what we'll call them: sacramentalism, mysticism, prophetic liberative praxis. I wonder why couldn't Larry find just one word? Prophetic liberative practice and asceticism. These are the four streams or traditions that are flowing throughout the Christian tradition. And another thing, we'll explore these a bit more deeply, but something else to hold out there as a promise for you all is Larry finds in these connections to other faith traditions as well. The Christian mystic will find much in common with a Hindu mystic, and may be able to find a way to work together, to live together, because they're both living in this kind of a stream or view of the world. As opposed to these streams, there are dams and blocks. I think dams would be a good way to talk about them. So as opposed to sacramentalism, I'm going to put these up here, would be utilitarianism. As opposed to mysticism, is alienation. As opposed to liberation, is oppression. And as opposed to asceticism, would be consumerism. So these are dams along the streams, or dams constructed within our human societies that have had an effect on our own bodies as well as the body of creation. So now that you see very briefly the four streams and some of the dams up, I'll take a little bit of time to go through each one of them and just to give you a little description of what we talk about when we're talking about sacramentalism. These are things that you probably have found and experienced in your own life, and I've got some examples from the life of the church, too. Sacramentalism, a good first story here, is St. James Cathedral in Seattle. The archbishop there took a reporter through the sanctuary and brought him to the baptismal font and said, "Look here, we baptize people in living water. These waters are flowing," and their baptismal font was actually flowing with water, moving water. "And this water is living, so is the water of the Columbia River and the Columbia Valley." And the archbishop there, as well as the bishops of the Northwest, made a statement calling the whole Columbia River Valley and watershed a sacramental commons, that this whole bioregion is imbued with God's presence. Just like the baptismal waters are, so is this whole watershed. So it makes a welcome. That's all right. It makes a connection, this sacramental way of viewing the world, of entering and being in the world, makes a connection between the sacraments of the church and how we understand God's presence in the water, the wine, and the bread, and that God is present in everything, and that we should be treating things like sacraments, this whole creation. So, some things that would go into this is that the divine is present in nature, that it is a common good. Or a common wealth. And that this nature is visible and tangible, just like the sacramental elements, bread, water, wine, human beings in the confession, that there is an extravagance, an abundance, the bread that is not just a little teeny wafer, but is a full basket overflowing that is shared at Holy Communion. That's the kind of image that sacramentalism would have us see. And that it's a medium of God's grace. Our act or response would be then thanksgiving and sharing. So like baptism or Holy Communion, we see these in the church as gifts not to be hoarded for ourselves, mostly. When we do hoard the gift of baptism or the gift of communion, I think that we're going against what God's intention is with this gift. It's a gift to be shared, not to be hoarded. Same way with the whole gift of creation. The gift of creation is to be shared and to be given thanks over. So we have an approach of gratitude and sharing in this. Some other examples of sacramentalism in church life and church work is that Lutheran World Relief, when they're doing water projects, for example, or when they have the posters that they're sending out to lots of congregations, make a connection between the waters of life and the water projects that they're doing in South America or Africa. When Judy and I were visiting Guatemala, there was a community that Lutheran World Federation and Lutheran World Relief were working with in order to get a little water pipe going out to this new colonia, this new settlement. And when they got the water pipe there, they had what looked like a baptismal service in order to celebrate that the water was brought to the community. So they make a direct connection between the sacrament of baptism and having healthy, clean water for people to drink and to be sustained by. In the utilitarianism, to contrast it, there's rather than a thanksgiving, there is and that God's presence is there, and it's God's presence that gives value to nature. Humans use nature. Nature becomes a resource or capital. It's no longer a gift. It's just something that we're going to use. And we and it's use for us that humans become very much the center of this whole utilitarianism. And the nature, partly like alienation, this is one place where the streams, or at least the dams, are connecting. Instead of, this becomes a subject, I mean an object, for human use. It and the great I. Say more about that when we get to alienation. But to give you a kind of a biblical story, you might have some that go along with this too. I think about Paul instructing the community at Corinth when they're going to celebrate Holy Communion, and they, he sees, are abusing the gift of Holy Communion itself, because the wealthier people who didn't have to work that day came early, they got all the food to eat, and when the poor or the workers came later at the end of the day, there is nothing left for them to eat. And they did not see that they were all one body and that they should be in communion with one another, sharing the gifts of creation. And that that table is the Eucharist, is not just for themselves, it's to be shared. And the sharing is for the sustenance of all. So that would be one example. What would be another biblical story or example of sacramentalism that you might see? People or Jesus or other figures in the Bible receiving the gifts of creation and sharing.
The loaves and fishes.
Loaves and fishes is an excellent example. So there, they take the gifts that have been given them, and they don't use it, this little boy or the disciples don't just use it for themselves. The disciples wanted to figure out, well, let's go away and get something for ourselves to eat. But Jesus said, no, there's food here. Let's share it. And by sharing it, but he gives thanks first, then shares it, and all are able to eat. To extravagance and abundance. There's so much of God's blessing in creation that there's abundance and stuff left over. What kind of hymns might come to mind? Any hymns come to mind for you?
For the beauty of the earth.
For the beauty of the earth. We sang it just last night. For the beauty of the earth. I also...
We gather together to pass thanksgiving.
Yeah, we gather to. I also found Great is Thy Faithfulness.
Uh-huh.
Great is Thy Faithfulness, talking about the gifts that God has given us, and that it's just the gift of creation. God's faithfulness is born out of the gift of creation. Or there's a offertory hymn sometimes that we sing, or a stewardship hymn, for the fruit of all creation, thanks be to God. And then for the second verse is talking about the gifts of human labor and how we share these gifts through our labor, thanks be to God, and for the harvest of the Spirit. So making this connection between the gifts of nature, the sharing, and the spiritual gifts as well. Any questions or comments about sacramentalism? All right, let's get to mysticism. Mysticism I guess telling just a personal story to explain this one. Once when I was senior in college, I went up to visit my grandpa in northern Minnesota, and he wanted to take me out to a friend of his that was an escapee from Wall Street. She had been a Wall Street broker, and then she went to northern Minnesota, and she, in a way, was living an ascetic life. We'll get to that. But I didn't ever get to meet her because she didn't have a phone, and so my grandpa wanted to take me out to meet her, and she wasn't there. We had to walk about half a mile through the woods because the road stopped, and then the rest of the way you had to walk to the cabin that she made for herself. So she wasn't there. But my grandpa said, okay, Mike, stand right here. So he stood me there, and then he started sprinkling stuff on me. He put my hands out like this, and he sprinkled bird seed on me, on my hair, on my hands, all over me, and suddenly songbirds came. He stepped away, and the songbirds came down from the trees, and they were eating out of my hands. They were flying around my head. And actually, I didn't feel afraid. I actually felt I had this mystical experience of oneness with all creation, that there I was with my grandfather, with standing, I just feel still this feeling the earth on in my feet and the birds around my head and the multiple perspectives that were going on.
and the different relationships all happening there. But this oneness, I felt like I was one with the living all. And I was out running here the other day, my first morning here, and I ran up to the waterfall and the crashing waters of creation there. And then I ran down to the road, was running back up, and a bear was there. And fortunately, the bear was off, you know, clawing at some bark and not on the road where I was. But I stopped, and we looked at each other, and I said, "Hi." And the bear is like, and then gets on the other side of the bark and the tree. But kind of interesting, you know, what kind of meeting was that? But the mysticism is a profound meeting. And union. It's we use the phrase that Martin Buber, I think it was him that came up with this. It's an I-thou,
yeah.
Where I am in such a deep union or relationship with the other, with the thou, that it actually even goes beyond I-thou to this union, almost a dissolution of this middle space to us being one in a mystical way. It's a direct experience.
And there's a place in our sacraments where the sacraments can take us into that mystical experience.
Yes, that's another place, is the flowing in of the one and the other. That we should talk about bread, too. When we get to the coffee, let's talk about bread. A direct experience with the living all. And the there's sometimes when people get to this point or have this experience, there's a fire or a cosmic fire that you have a sense of, that you're part of that holy energy that is just alive. And that these experiences are sometimes or oftentimes episodic. They're not continuous. We don't usually live continuously in this mystical space. But afterwards, we come back with a heightened sense of the disjointedness of our world, of the disconnections in our world, and the brokenness of it. And mystics, people who live in this experience a lot, oftentimes have a heart that is broken when they see what we do to one another, or how the earth is weeping itself, groaning. But the response, like this response off the back here, is thanksgiving and sharing. Oftentimes the mystics, they're response could be described as compassion. Walking and living with compassion. For any kind of Bible stories that come to mind, or Bible verses that come to mind for you?
How about the burning bush?
The burning bush, yeah, is an example of that, really, the cosmic fire there, the very presence of God right there with you.
I think turning the other cheek, I think that's only possible when you're just totally absorbed with doing God's will. It's impossible based on your own sense of self-protection.
Mm-hmm. So that it's that being totally immersed in the living all leads you to being able to be compassionate.
Yeah.
Every moment.
The birth of Christ.
How's the birth of Christ mystical?
Because it's that the incredible intimacy of that moment where someone's holy God and holy man, you know, of God but of human at the same time. That's, mm-hmm. you know, that's just that moment when that separation happens between Mary, the mother of Jesus, and Christ now fully formed as God.
Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. The John's prologue, where instead of talking about the actual birth, like maybe Luke does a bit, John takes that union mystically, just expands it, or does his own contemplation of it, so that there's the Word was God, and all creation was created through that Word, and the Word is in the world. And so that's a kind of a mystical interpretation of the Word is in everything. Meister Eckhart said, so full is every creature of the Word of God that I don't have to do a sermon other than just to contemplate the caterpillar, because that caterpillar is so full of the Word of God. So that kind of right there. Again, the contrary. Oh, hymns? Any hymns that come to mind?
How great thou art.
How great thou art. That you're in these mountains and valleys and there's this oneness that you experience.
Holy, holy, holy.
Holy, 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 yeah. Have you all heard of or sung the song Mothering God? That's one, or Earth and All Stars.
Oh, yeah.
Earth and All Stars. It's got all of the parts of creation, human beings, all singing together. I want to read for you Mothering God.
Yes, can't put the song yet.
Because it goes along with what Rita was saying. Mothering God, you gave me birth in the bright morning of this world. Creator, source of every breath, you are my rain, my wind, my sun. Mothering Christ, you took my form, offering me your food of light, grain of life and grape of love, very body for my peace. Mothering Spirit, nurturing one, in arms of patience hold me close, so that in faith I root and grow, until I flower, until I know. That's a poem based on Julian of Norwich. And so she was a mystic in a number of ways. And in this poem, the vision she has is this unity between the child and the mother still. And even being rooted, that continuing union, rooted in the divine, until I flower. So we're the image that we have of ourselves is as a creation image. Alienation. This is a great split. The mind over matter. The I, it again. And the spirit. Especially this is infected into our church theology, spirit over body. And so even this alienation, not only are we alienated from the rest of creation, God, we are alienated from ourselves. Spirit and body, we become alienated from ourselves. So self-alienation. Like a bit in the utilitarianism, you see it's the I-it, that nature is simply a means to an end. And Kant, Immanuel Kant, said that nature is a means to an end, and that end is man. And I keep the sexist language in there, because in much of alienation, female and male, so there's a split, a deep sexism, a misogyny that's built into this kind of alienation that's contrary to mysticism. When you think of mystics, people, like I read you Julian of Norwich, Hildegard of Bingen, or someone who I think is a modern mystic, Annie Dillard. Mm-hmm. A lot of mystics tend to be women. Perhaps because they can't live, maybe, so well with this kind of a split.
neither can men. We cut off our heads, and our bodies die. That's the secret there. Any comments or questions about mysticism and alienation?
One of the interesting things in teaching biology to sophomores has been kind of showing that, you know, you talk about the unity of life to them. Well, how am I really that similar to a plant? And you start showing them, well, you share this percentage of your DNA with a plant, or this part of your DNA and your mitochondria is the same shape as a bacteria.
Uh-huh.
And they have a really hard time getting that, that they really have that at that very, very basic level, a deep sharing with some of the simplest and all the forms of life on the planet. So that's always kind of fun for me to turn them on their heads like that a little bit.
Yeah. It's a really good example of helping us recognize that there isn't this split between humanity and the rest of creation, that we are of a piece, and science can help us understand that, see that.
Like,
yes.
From the Celtic perspective, the relationship is even a little different than the stewardship that we speak of so frequently in the Christian community. It's certainly not dominion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even stewardship of a Celtic perspective, it's kinship, which all of the Aboriginal people seem to understand intuitively.
I think, yeah, in that mysticism, I think the word that is missing is intimacy. Because, you know, it is an intimate relationship, you know, between spouses, between children and parents, between earth and humanity.
Yeah, intimate, very, very good.
I don't think that's a stream that I find myself in very often. It's not where I live, I think. But I was reminded of many years ago, the first time I took biochemistry. And, you know, I'd been in the class for weeks. And the professor put up this overhead that was all the biochemical pathways and how the products and intermediate products fit together. And it was this religious experience. Like, oh my goodness.
Citric acid cycle.
Yeah, right.
Connected to
all these other pathways. All these connections.
Yes.
I see, you know, that alienation versus mysticism. And we live in the Northwoods of Minnesota, and we feel global warming in many different ways. As part of, I think, the cause of that is people who live in the country and people who live in the city are really alienated from the standpoint that people who are raised in the city who never get to go out and experience nature, it's very easy for them to not value the power of nature and how nature connected. The whole global warming and our destruction of the natural world, our abuse, the it.
Yeah.
You can have that mystical experience of sitting in the woods and listening to this.
We live in Washington, D.C., and go up to Baltimore sometimes, and if you've been to Baltimore or seen pictures of it, it's an old city, and literally in some neighborhoods, you go with the pavement of the street to the sidewalk to the houses right there, and then to these little backyards that are mostly gravel and paved over now, to the alleyway, to that same thing repeated over and over again. Not a single tree or blade of grass, unless creation, God, has a plan to, you know, break through that concrete or rubble. But you can go for miles and not see just wild creation. You see manufactured stuff that is designed to keep us separate from the earth that's below. Concrete is a form of earth, so I'm not, but we've manufactured it, molded it in a certain you know, utilitarian way, but definitely to split us as well.
Going off to Narnia.
Yeah, Narnia, sorry.
Okay.
Songs for prophetic alliterative.
Yeah.
What can't the turning and send down the fire.
All right.
So pretty good.
Good thing for you. That's a great way to start. Canticle of the Turning. Let's move on to prophetic liturgical practices with the hymn. Mary's Magnificat, her song is again about this birth narrative. She's singing because something great is happening in her body, in her life, and she sees it in the whole life of creation, and that it's going to turn the tables, that it's going to right wrongs. The liberative, prophetic liberative praxis, or practice, definitely sees the injustices and looks at our practices, where our pocketbooks are and where our checkbooks are determined or can reveal the truth about our lives. And so there's this way that the prophetic practice, prophetic perspective, sees very quickly and easily the brokenness and the injustice in our human relationships. Going back to some biblical stories there, the Exodus story, God bringing the Hebrews out of slavery in Egypt and bringing them into the promised land, teeming with milk and honey. So there's in the Bible, in the Old Testament, replete images of when there's injustice, there's barrenness in the world, in the creation. And when there's justice in human relationships, there is also health, healing, and wholeness in all of creation. I want to read you, go right to the Bible, skip here, Isaiah 24. Oops. So Isaiah is being blessed by God with the Spirit to be able to see and call out the injustices in his community, for her community. He says, the earth dries up and withers, the world languishes and withers, the heavens languish together with the earth. The earth lies polluted under its inhabitants, for they have transgressed laws, violated statutes, broken the everlasting covenant. Isaiah sees a direct connection between the injustices in the human community and the degradation of the rest of creation. Isaiah also sees a connection between the healing or the bringing of justice, the coming of the Messiah, and the joy of all creation. In Isaiah 35, the wilderness and the dry land shall be glad, the desert shall rejoice and blossom. Like the crocus, it shall blossom abundantly and rejoice with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, and so forth. And this is all when God's Messiah is coming, and the exiles are greeting the Messiah. But that not just the human beings, but all creation blossoms at the approach of the Messiah. Also, Psalm 85 for me is an example where sometimes it's talked about as the little editorial column will be thanksgiving for the harvest or something, but at the end, you'll get where justice and peace kiss, where righteousness and steadfastness, steadfast love meet together. So there's this understanding that, and then it talks about truth shall spring up from the earth and righteousness rain down. So there's an understanding of that the whole creation is involved in this bringing of peace and justice and shalom. So there's a vision of shalom that's healing, restorative. And that all creation, not just humanity, is subject to or for liberation. That all creation is suffering the injustice, so therefore all creation is subject to redemption or liberation. It's not that in this, from an environmental perspective, it's not just about human beings being freed from slavery. It's the whole creation being slave, being freed from domination and oppression. What's in the notes? So I guess there's two. There's so many stories in the Bible of this. I guess I can keep on. You got any examples? Let me throw it out to you all. Any examples of the Bible, from the Bible, about prophetic liberative practices that link justice and creation? Or injustice?
The Israelites in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
Oppression and the effect of the land as well as the people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The little short verse in Micah, what does the Lord require of you? You know,
to do justice, to practice love and kindness, and walk humbly with your God. Mm-hmm. When Cain kills Abel, the Bible says the earth cries out. So the first human sin, injustice, one to another, and the earth cries out. Jesus' own crucifixion, the Gospels talk about that the earth shakes and trembles itself. Jesus, when he is going into Jerusalem and the people are saying, Hosanna, the Son of David, and they're telling all the kids to be quiet, and Jesus says, even the stones will cry out. Even the stones will cry out. Even if you silence all humanity, the stones themselves will call out for God's liberation. But any hymns come to mind?
Even the stones will cry out for justice.
Yeah, Raven Keeper's song. Even the stones will cry out for justice.
Follow the drinking gourd.
Follow the drinking gourd?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. One that came to mind is that Advent tune, Advent song. All of this hopeful, the Savior comes at last. Furrows lie open for God's creature cast. Now I'm getting it all off, but there's this beautiful Advent hymn about the coming of God, the coming of the Messiah, and that all creation is again.
Well, even O Come Emmanuel.
O Come Emmanuel.
And ransom captive Israel.
Uh huh.
And so we're all captives.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to the aesthetic. Get that up. I guess I'm not going to say much about oppression. It's pretty. One thing about the prophetic liberative praxis is that it, like I said, it has the eyes to see this oppression fairly clearly and pulls it out. Asceticism is marked by self-control and I didn't need my notes, sorry. And it has humbleness and not arrogant.
So what's the difference between self-control and self-denial?
Well, self-denial would be a way to say denying the passions of this life. I think self-control might be a little bit healthier to think about in that, because self-denial can sometimes and has led to some unhealthy ascetic behaviors where it's a
self-hate, basically.
Self-hate,
yeah.
Yeah, the flagellation, getting yourself up. But it's a... It's being not of this world, but not of creation. Okay? So there is sometimes another form of dualism that comes in here. That there's a way of
the old creature with our passions and desires and sinfulness, and that by careful discipline, we can control those passions that are consumptive, gluttonous, frenetic, and self-serving. And in by the disciplines of fasting, of solitude, but solitude not an absence of communal labor, we are putting in check gluttony, the frenetic behavior of so much busyness in our lives, and by communal labor, we're relieving ourselves of tedium and drudgery, perhaps, that is relegated to a certain group of people, as well as the status that comes from a division of labor. So, asceticism like that. There is St. Francis, in one sense, he could fit into a lot of these streams. But you know how at one point he strips himself of all of his clothes? And there's two things going on here, in a sense. One is that the ascetic wants to strip oneself of all of the ways that we prop ourselves up and think that we're the ones that have given ourselves all of this stuff, that we are dependent upon ourselves only. And the ascetic wants to strip oneself of everything so that they can ever more fully be dependent upon God and seeing themselves as that God is the one who gives them everything that they need to live, not any of their own creation.
Then once again, that word self-control. I mean, if you're talking about God is in control, then a true aesthetic would give the power over to God and not seize the power for themselves. Sort of like, you know, the 12-step concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be good. But, yeah. Yeah, I guess that's another way of saying it, and maybe a healthier way, too. That it's... And this God-centered and self-control is that rather than this acquiring and consumptive behavior, it's more of a receiving and sometimes literally taking, but it becomes rather than a taking, like robbing, it's a taking that becomes mutual. I take from the fruit of the earth and I give back as well, and all the way from the composting, you know. So there's this way that I'm in the creation and a part of it. And being in creation is an important part of the ascetic. The, you know, going off to the secluded places, to the wild places. The ascetic does not see these places as deserted of God's presence. In fact, in these wild places, the ascetic sees that being inhabited by God, and that they're able to move away from those places where we've built up monuments to ourselves and whole systems to ourselves, and there in these wild places, stripped away of all of those things, we again can see and live more deeply into a God-centered way. Got any hymns or songs that come to mind?
We give thee but thine own.
Uh-huh.
Take my life and let it be, and consecrate it to thee.
Take my life.
Earth and vessels, put earth and vessels.
I sometimes think maybe there's no hymn. Maybe there's silence.
Silence, yeah.
Silence.
Gregorian chant.
Gregorian chant, or the Tezé chant came to my mind. Mm-hmm. Eat this bread, drink this cup, come to me and never be hungry. Just very simple, and it gets very elemental very quickly. Eat, drink, never be hungry, never be thirsty. Good. Any Bible verses or stories that come to mind?
Do you remember the lilies?
Yeah! Consider the lilies. They don't worry about things. They just are clothed by God. So 40 they're
days
40
days in the wilderness.
40 days in the wilderness. Yeah.
And both from 40 years and 40 days. Both Moses and Jesus.
Yep. I think that 40 days in the or 40 years in the wilderness is a really nice example of a communal ascetic. That every day receiving the manna and the quail, and then not being able to do anything other than to just receive and gather. And then Jesus, this 40 days in the wilderness fasting, John the Baptist's ascetic life that he lived. So, there. So let's take, while we've got a few more minutes, take coffee. Got my coffee cup. So if I were standing in these different streams, how might you, or if you were standing in one of these streams, how would you think about this cup of coffee? How would you make decisions about coffee? Think about it in sacramentalism.
Well, you brew it more nicely and slowly. I mean, why did Starbucks fail? Because their baristas started doing the prepackaged stuff, and they took away the relationship of grinding the beans and talking to you. You know, well, in this sort of sacramentalism with the food itself, it slowed the process down, developed a relationship in the store itself that sort of disappeared. And they lost money.
Right.
I remember reading a story about coffee coming from the New World into Europe about the same time Martin Luther was beginning his, and there's some discussion about whether coffee is truly a sacrament of the Lutheran Church. But it's most elemental form.
Why is it a sacrament of the Lutheran Church?
Because it's fellowship and hospitality.
There, yeah. Mm-hmm. The third sacrament, we joke about it in their churches, but it is because we're sharing this coffee, this element, with one another, and it's a fellowship opportunity.
It isn't about getting out of worship and heading for the car.
Mm-hmm.
It's about staying and having community.
Yeah. Here at Holden, we just finished having coffee hour, the coffee break. So that, and we, if we're the relationship, the abundance, the caring for it well, so that it's good coffee, not this, you know, oh, I can see the bottom of my cup coffee. there's an abundance there. The caring probably for the coffee plantations and, you know, making sure that the fruit of the tree is really well done. Sometimes we forget about the Thanksgiving part, I think, about coffee, even in this sacramental element of it, that coffee is a gift. If we think about it in a sacramental way, how are we giving thanks? How are we receiving it with thanksgiving? More so than an addict that just needs to use it, like me at times, or a consumer who just like, I need my coffee. Well, what about the mystic? How would a mystic approach this cup of coffee?
More caffeine! More caffeine!
Well, maybe not. I don't know. I don't get that part.
Well, no, I'm just saying I consider myself a mystic, and I mean, of course, it turns into alienation rather quickly.
Uh-huh.
But that's what I first think of when I drink it.
Uh-huh. Like drugs, it gives you a feeling of euphoria and keeps you from falling asleep.
You know, there is that. I get you now because every once in a while I'll wake up and I'll get just the one little drop on my tip, the tip of my tongue, and it'll feel like, wow. This whole, whoa, I'm alive. Yeah. That might not be the
the most religious view.
but here, has anybody seen the movie Sideways?
Yes.
Where it takes place in Central California.
And
it's two friends that go out into the wine country. And one of the guys is talking to a woman. A man's talking to a woman. And he asks her why she loves wine. And she says, because of what it makes me think, what it makes me feel. Because when I drink a glass of wine, I am thinking about death. I'm thinking about the field and the volcanic ash and wondering what happened in that season that this grape was produced. And did the people who plucked those grapes, did they prick their fingers
And was their blood mingled in with this grape juice that made the wine?
She's having this, she's going off on this mystical riff, really. And she, it takes her into these deep experiences. So every once in a while, or mindfulness could be a way, you know, a Buddhist practice or way of thinking about this is mindfulness.
Yes.
So when I drink this cup, and sometimes I've started to do this, I slow myself down and I smell the aroma and I taste it, and it can at times, not in the addictive way, but in a more mystical union, transport me into, this coffee, this fruit of the earth is one with me and I'm one with it. And it makes me think like that woman, and the wine makes her think differently.
It's also the, like hot chocolate or tea, or after you go out in the snow, the warmth, the care, the love that you feel when you're cold from a warm cup of, you know, any liquid.
Yeah, it's the cosmic fire in my cup.
Back to the sacramentalism as a tea drinker.
Mm-hmm.
I can't write a sermon unless I have my tea.
Uh-huh.
It has to be there. And part of it is there's that water that comes from the ground that goes into the tea, that goes into my body, that gives me all that wonderful juices that are in the body and the thought process, all of that. And then somehow the word of God comes out through all of that.
What about the prophetic liberative praxis? How would I approach this cup of coffee?
Where would only drink fair trade.
Fair trade.
Shade grown.
Organic.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what kind of coffee we drink here
locally
at Holding Village? How could it be locally grown?
It can't. That's what makes it interesting. That's the dilemma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know what kind of coffee we drink here?
It's highly acidic.
It's from Cafe Mom. And it is fair trade, organically grown, shade grown, bought by indigenous cooperatives.
Carried on the back of Lutherans from.
See,
using no gas or oil.
Now there is in this, you know, right away in this prophetic liberative thing, we start wondering, well, what about other aspects of this trade? Just because it's fair trade and we bought it, does it mean that it didn't use any diesel oil or products to get up the river, up the lake here,
mm-hmm.
in order to get to Holden Village?
Mm-hmm. Should we compromise the environment by getting it there?
So, but in this tradition, we start thinking about those justice issues. What are the baristas being paid at Starbucks or at the other places where we go to buy our coffee?
Mm-hmm.
Do they get health insurance? All that kind of stuff falls into here. What about the aesthetic? How would the aesthetic?
Don't drink too
much.
Don't
drink it at all.
You don't need it. I don't need coffee. All I need really is water.
Yes.
You know, just set this aside. Fast from it. Get free of the consumerist addictions. And don't
drink tea instead.
Drink tea instead.
Or buy a cup and give it to somebody else.
Or like this issue of the transport for the coffee. Some of the tea here at Holden Village is produced by the plants right here in this valley. So there's a locally grown version of a beverage.
But it's not real tea.
It's not real tea.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. It could be a different beverage.
There's a great radio ad that plays in the Seattle area. It's actually an insurance ad, but Northwest Profile, and they talk about this guy who goes to the coffee stand, orders this coffee that takes, you know, it's literally almost a whole 30-second ad of all the triple vente, you know, it's just this long string of instructions, and that's you know, perfect issue of the consumerism around it, of I'm going to get it exactly the way I want, to the smallest detail, and it terrorizes the barista with this long, it's a, which just came to me as they
Yeah. Well, so we did this with coffee. We don't have time to, like, do the bread part, but, you know, you could think about bread in these ways.
the smell, the aroma of baking bread and being involved in that, or the bread of the lack, the hunger, that people don't have bread to eat. But you can also think about this and in your individual choices that you're making in daily living. But we can also use these streams in the Christian tradition to think about some more grand issues, like the bishops did here in the Northwest on the Columbia watershed, using a sacramental stream in order to give some guidance and advice on how to care for this gift of creation. So these could give us some tools in which to make some ethical decisions on a much wider scale than only the personal and private ones.
Can I just share a short story?
Sure.
I think that as I look to the categories, I think between the two, sometimes you need crisis to help you find the other. And the story I'm going to tell is just one thing I did in acting. I was at a member of a church, Zion Lutheran in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and they hired a new minister who just cleaned house. He was a bull in a china shop, but he was, and I never quite understood. He seemed like a nice guy. And I never had time to talk to him. So during communion one time, and there's lots of stories like this, fortunately or unfortunately in my life, where he offered me communion, and I thrust my hand on his heart while he was giving him communion, put my hand on his head, and I said, "I forgive you." And, of course, he backed away like, "Is this guy wacko or something?" You know, and I thought, why did I do that? You know? And there's other, you know, and I think for me, between the crisis period that I think, when I say crisis, I'm not talking about denial or not self-denial. I have not nearly enough self-discipline for that to be a problem. But I think what it is for me is I find myself doing things like that sometimes can be a bit audacious. Mm-hmm. And I find me like acting like God, what God has me do. Sometimes I'd like to get into a place where I'm waiting and somehow I get acted on by somebody else, mm-hmm. thrusting me in a situation. And in some ways that would be my prayer for myself in holding this week. If I could open myself up to not just listening more, but listening more deeply, mm-hmm. you know. I hope that wasn't too long.
No. Sometimes, you know, what is resonating with me with that is a spirituality of these things, mm-hmm. of how can these things become practices where they're experiences and practices of the divine in our life. Mm-hmm. So coming to Holden Village is maybe... Could be seen as an ascetic move mm-hmm. to try to remove yourself from the trappings of the worldly things that we all have. It could also be seen as, you know, oftentimes mystical experiences happen when you're in creation.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So by coming out here, you're putting yourself in a spot where it might happen, like it did for me, you know, running down
the
road here. So there's ways that we can engage in a spirituality for each of these issues, too. Extremes. Well, it's our time is up. Thank you all for being with us.